Владимир Путин раньше уже рассказывал, что очень любит
Сейчас
историю.
Сейчас проходит встреча президента с педагогами.
Напомнил о важной роли истории в развитии.
Владимир Путин выступил против попыток переписать...
Историками Владимир Путин вел, можно сказать, на равных.
Приобретаем огромное количество сторонников, подчеркнул Владимир Путин.
Это было действительно заметно.
He who controls the past controls the future. And he who controls the present controls the past. It's a lesson Vladimir Putin understands well. And one he is putting into practice as we speak. This week, Putin met in the Kremlin with young Russian historians to offer some friendly guidance on how Russia's past should be represented and presented. Putin has taken quite an interest in history of late, and this interest in his country's past has ominous overtones for Russia's present and its future. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is Rim Gilfanov, a historian who is also director of RFERL's Tatar Bashkir service. Welcome, Rim.
Thanks for inviting.
Thanks for coming. And joining us on the Skype line from New York City is Nina Khrushcheva, a professor at the New School and author of the book The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome back, Nina.
Thank you.
And also joining us via Skype from London, making her first but hopefully not last appearance on the podcast, is Ola Chihovlas, a journalist covering Russia whose work has appeared in The New Republic, Foreign Policy, Politico, Forbes, and elsewhere, and who has also worked for the rights group Memorial. Welcome aboard, Ola.
Hi, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Ola, by tradition, new guests get the privilege of getting the ball rolling, so you're up. As I noted, you did some work with Memorial in Perm, specifically at the Perm 36 site, a Stalin-era labor camp. And you recently wrote a piece for the New Republic about how the Kremlin is trying to whitewash the history of the Gulag. Can you talk a little bit more about that for us?
Yeah, so Perm 36 is a very unique place. You mentioned that it's a Stalinist gulag, but actually what interested me the most about Perm 36 is its history in the late Soviet period. Perm 36 was a average prison camp, just like any other prison camp in the dozens that existed around the Soviet Union. But in 1972, the camp was converted into the harshest political camp in the country, and it operated until 1988. So that's really what I want to focus on. Perm 36, when I first arrived in Russia in 2011, end of 2010, early 2011, Perm was a very different place than it is now. The governor was a man called Oleg Cherkunov, who was given this grand role to make a cultural revolution in Russia. Cherkunov had, obviously, some, as any governor in Russia has these days, some KGB ties, but was actually very forward-thinking in terms of compared to the governors next door in the Sverdlovsk region or the Kirov region. So Perm 36, when I first arrived in 2010, was actually doing fairly well and receiving a fair bit of funding. Had a fairly good reputation in town. A lot of schools were involved in Perm 36, local schools in Perm. A lot of foreigners came, especially from Germany and from Poland, to keep the camp, the museum in Perm 36 going. And everything started going downhill at the end of 2011, beginning of 2012. So Perm 36, in sort of my experience in Russia, because I never lived in Moscow that long, but I lived in Perm for a while, Perm 36 was this window of light where festivals and very open-minded conferences were taking place in Perm. And suddenly that all started dying down, so I saw it from the grassroots, from the bottom level, where the people of Perm were told to sort of disassociate themselves from Memorial and from Perm 36. The funding was cut. Our officers started to get harassed.
And this all began late 2011, early 2012, which we all know what that coincided with.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess the story of PAM 36 after 2011 is also the story of Russia, sort of its descent and nosedive into authoritarianism, and Putin sort of cracking down on civil society.
Yeah, no, and I think I'm glad you said the story of PERM 36 is the story of Russia, because here you had this this memorial site, this museum, if you will, to keep the memory of the Gulag alive, and the group memorial had a big role in that. It was doing well, and then suddenly, and it survived Putin's first two terms fine, right? It was my understanding, but suddenly, when Putin came back to power in 2012, there was this new interest in history. And in rewriting history. So one of the things you do in journalism is you use the little story to tell the big story. Now, I know you've written not just about PERM 36, but you've written a lot about historical revisionism. I mean, how could you extrapolate on this a little bit? And we've seen kind of broader trends that PERM 36 kind of illustrates. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've seen Putin manipulating Russians using revisionist history sort of well before 2011. These comments that he made this week, which we're going to talk about later, I guess, about the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact. These are nothing new. There's nothing new about these comments. We've had this rhetoric coming from the Kremlin long before 2011, long before Ukraine, long before the protests.
But it's dialed up to 11 now, so to speak.
But I think it's obviously very worrying because it's not just words. I mean, Putin is now, by saying that Hitler and Stalin carving up Europe is okay, is basically legitimizing his own, the way he's changing Europe's borders by force as well. So I think it makes Eastern Europe especially tremble and shiver. But also for Russians, for a distance once again, being a threat to the Russian regime. Vladimir Bukovsky this week said, I mean, I'm not sure how the story's evolved today or yesterday, but he said that the Russians were not letting him go back to Russia.
Yeah, they're not renewing his passport.
Yeah.
So
incidentally, he actually was in PAM 36, mm-hmm. So it's quite telling.
Yeah, no, it's. I'm glad you mentioned the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, because that gives me a good segue, because this was there was a couple of headline grabbing comments Putin made in his meeting with the historians, and one of the biggest ones was the comments about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. So let's listen to Putin talk about that now.
The Soviet Union signed a non-aggression pact with Germany. What's wrong with that? Why is it bad that the Soviet Union didn't want to go to war? And knowing that war was inevitable, the Soviet Union needed time to modernize its army. It needed new armaments.
Now, Putin seems to be leaving out a pretty important little detail here. Right, the secret protocols of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which provided for the division of Europe between Hitler and Stalin at the end of the day. Nina, your family has been the victim of more than a little bit of historical revisionism. When you listen to Putin make a statement like this, what are your thoughts?
Well, he's not original. I mean, I have to say anything Vladimir Putin does is brilliant, but not original. So we've seen that before. And yes, thank you for saying we're the victims of historical revisionism. But, you know, my predecessors were also very much engaged in certain revisionism as well. So I cannot really say victim, because that's how the Soviet leaders function. And we've discussed many times on this program, Putin's type is a Soviet leader type. So he decides what history is. And he moves on with that decision. Basically, I think I find that meeting with young historians, usually I read it very carefully, they're young historians. So he's brainwashing the young people, those who will be in position to be here in 2017, because they're gearing towards the celebration or denouncement of the Bolshevik Revolution, because that's so clearly now we know that Putin really certainly plans to stay there until 2017. And so for them, I think it's probably not. I mean, I understand that Europe is shivering and trembling. I don't think he's going to recarve the NATO countries, clearly. That's not going to happen unless he really wants to take a big bluff. But he's reshaping the minds of the Russians, how to read about themselves, how to understand their now again. You know, we're back to 11 time zones, so congratulations to us. We got bigger again, which is basically defines our greatness. And I think that's what's so important, is that suddenly decisions become very subjective. And he was in his comments, he keep repeating that history, that decisions were made this way at the time. So why are we judging that from contemporary Western point of view? As Ola said, justifying his own carving into other parts of Europe and whatnot. But I thought also, I mean, Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is very important because there was a lot of conversation during this meeting about Second World War, because Second World War is now going to be redone, rewritten. For example, there's another moment that I thought was very important, that the military commanders from World War One were in charge of World War Two, and well, that's actually not true because most of them were killed, so they didn't. So a lot of these things are being reshaped, more so for the benefit of the Russian or new Russian. It's not even Tsarist ideology. I think it's the Kievan Russia ideology more than anything, and this kind of agreement is now going to fit into the new Rurik dynasty, which I imagine Vladimir Putin is now going to be benefactor from.
Yeah, no, we're going to talk a little bit about the Rurik dynasty, and Rim's going to have some things to say about that as in the latter part. No, it's interesting that you do point out these are young historians, but this does fit into something quite interesting, Nina. And I'm glad you raised this, because I recently put a post up on my blog, the Putin's Class of 2014, and this is basically about how the FSB is essentially vetting young bureaucrats between the ages of 25 and 35 in the provinces that come from poor families, are rootless, and are very easily molded, and they're being brought to Moscow and strategically placed throughout the bureaucracy. And so the seeding that's going on, it reminded me immediately of Stalin's class of 38. But the other thing that's going on is they're seeding a whole new class of young historians. One has to wonder how much staying power this is all going to have, and that's another issue entirely. I wanted to go into another quote about Molotov-Ribbentrop that Putin made at this meeting with young historians.
Disputes about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact are still ongoing, with the Soviet Union being blamed for the division of Poland. Well, how about Poland itself? What did it do when the Germans invaded Czechoslovakia? Poland took a chunk of Czechoslovakia for itself. Poland itself did it. And then it got hit in the teeth in response.
Now, we're seeing another one of Putin's tactics here when he plays with history. In the first cut, we saw basically just leaving something out very important that really defines the whole thing. In other words, the secret protocols of the Molotov. Here, he's doing another game he likes to play. It's equivalency, or whataboutism, right? What he's doing here is he's trying to say there's some kind of equivalence between Hitler and Stalin's partition of Poland and Poland's seizure of Czechoslovakia's Tessin district, which in my understanding of that historically, I'm no expert in this, but my understanding of it is Poland was concerned about the ethnic Poles that were living in this district who were fine in Czechoslovakia, but weren't going to be fine in a Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. That's my understanding of that event. And then got the last part of the quote where he says they got hit in the teeth for this, as if the invasion of Poland were somehow a reaction to this. I don't get that. Ola, you're of Polish heritage. What's your reaction to this equivalency? I bet you didn't know Poland was just as bad as Stalin in this period.
No, I wasn't aware. I mean, first of all, the intervention and annexation of Zaolzie in 1938 by the Poles is widely recognized by most respected historians as being a mistake and a tragedy that actually played into Hitler's hands. But, I mean, I think, well, what he's essentially saying here is that the strong will always be able to do as they please with the weak. and he sort of doesn't believe that anyone has changed since the 1930s.
Exactly.
He doesn't, he sort of is still, I don't know if he is going back to or always was in this 1930s sort of mindset. And he basically is saying that whatever you guys say, you don't really believe it. We're all in this sort of David and Goliath mentality still. I mean, those comments are very shocking to anyone who knows what really happened in World War II. And obviously the Soviet Nazi Pact was recognized as sort of one of the most disastrous pacts in history. But I mean, the Soviets claimed for years that basically what Putin is saying is that Russia or the Soviet Union tried to get Britain and France to contain Hitler together, but they were unresponsive. So his narrative is that the USSR almost saved peace, but the West ruined it. So it sort of plays into this rising, well, increasingly very anti-Western history. And essentially, his version of history underlines that because Russia's victory over fascism and claims that Russia should have universal recognition and to be part of the world that it essentially created. So, I mean, by obviously those words whitewash any kind of Eastern European suffering. But more importantly, it's sort of his vision of the world order that hasn't really changed and still exists in his mind.
Yeah, no, you make the point that Putin's kind of living in the 1930s, and we're going to hear a little bit later from the Russian historian Nikita Sokolov, who made this point on Dosh TV as well.
Can I just add something? Because I totally agree with Ola, but I would even move him further than the 1930s. I would put him into World War One, because he does seem to deal or treat Russia or Russia's role in the world the way Germany was treating Germany during World War One.
Yeah,
it's that it had hurt feelings. The West is, other Western countries really betrayed us, and therefore we have to do what we have to do. And in some ways, I find it very, very interesting that that as much as Putin barrages Nazi Germany or Germany at times, period, he actually goes back to the German formulas and takes Poland as his main enemy once again. And this is actually very Stalinesque.
Remember that article that appeared in Izvestia early in the Ukraine crisis about the good Hitler.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
The good Hitler.
And they're
right?
still going
the
in.
The one that seized the Sudetenlands was fine. He was fine till he invaded the Soviet Union.
Right.
Also, I mean, one of the points Nikita Sokolov made on Dosh TV, and again, as I said, we'll be hearing from him a little later, is that Putin acts as the world as if the norms of the world haven't changed.
Absolutely.
That it's okay that we seized Crimea now because, well, the good Hitler seized the Sudetenland, and I guess that's okay. It's not okay with me, but apparently it's okay to him. And so there's this, again, this not just moral equivalency between things that are completely different, but historical equivalency between completely different epochs with different rules and different norms. Putin also had some very interesting things to say about the 1938 Munich Agreement, and I want to listen to a quote about that now, because this one kind of got my attention as much as the Molotov-Ribbentrop ones.
1938 год, да? Это Мюнхенский сговор, так называемый.
In 1938, there was the Munich Agreement. What is this? Your colleagues in the West are silent about it. After signing the agreement, Chamberlain came back with a piece of paper and said, "We'll have peace." And the Czechs understood that now the war was inevitable. Because appeasing the aggressor, in this case Hitler's Germany, led to a major military conflict.
I think it would come to a surprise, Rim, to any Western historian or any Westerner, anybody that's ever had a history class from the level of high school up in any Western country, that Western historiography ignores the Munich Agreement. My God, there's something it's drilled into your heads from the first time you study World War II, the lessons of Munich. Don't appease the aggressor. I've heard it in pop songs. You know, it's about the lessons of Munich is something that's almost an archetype in the West. And to say that that your colleagues in the West ignore this, Rim, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I don't think that we have to learn and study history from Putin, though he positions himself as an amateur historian. But he's still a politician, first of all, and politician with certain set of bizarre values. So we have to keep in mind this. And he leads the country, which is becoming more and more vulnerable last month because of given latest circumstances and in latest situation.
You mean the economic situation.
Economic situation, political and isolationist situation, we all know. And so he's here just a political leader trying to forge an ideology to consolidate the people to stand against West, and the so-called proper history is one of the main, if not the first, among tools to achieve this goal. To create a new nation, to bring it to a new level of concentration, consolidation around this new ideology and around new leader, which he probably thinks himself. And just look on some expressions he said during this meeting, which clearly reminded, at least for me, instructions. It wasn't like a meeting of the historians and our colleagues already.
No, it was instructions. It was friendly guidance.
Yeah.
It was
friendly, softly leading to certain points he believes in, so the others also pick it up and develop it further. For example, he said historians have to defend Russian views on information space, meaning information battlefield. Or our vision of history should be presented in attractive package. Defense of our historical position should be done in smart way, elegantly.
It's marketing.
It's marketing. I mean, new
or propaganda.
Well, I was being kind.
So in these terms, I think our esteemed colleagues already noticed that the audience was very, very interesting, because I didn't see any leading or famous historians over there. Just look at all those guys, I mean, who Putin meets with. They are young, and which is also important, money-savvy. Pragmatic people, as I understood. Some of them even went through famous pro-Putin Seliger camp, for example, which says a lot. So they are ready to start immediately working on goals guided by the leader. So that was the reason. And if you remember, I noticed one thing. Previously, Kremlin also tried several times to instruct historians. Yeah. There was a special committee.
Well, there's this plan to make the national textbook
To fight against falsification, so-called falsifications against Russian or Soviet history. So all of those leading historians who attended these meetings, they in their speeches, they were agreed, but nothing came out. Actually, did not work out.
2007, there was a book, as you remember, the instruction for teachers was Stalin was a good manager. So something did come out, but...
Well, it was really marginal, you know. And now they are trying to get to make it more official, to put it in like a part of ideology. And for those, these new guys are just perfect.
Yeah. Well, again, this is just another sign that Putin plans to stick around for a long time. You got the bureaucrats coming in, you got the historians being brainwashed, and it's another sign. Now, Rim, you studied history in the Soviet Union. You studied history at Kazan State University, which I'm proud to say is the university where I learned the Russian language.
In Tatarstan.
In Tatarstan, but they had very good Russian teachers at Kazan State University. You studied history in the Soviet Union. I mean, how were you indoctrinated like this? Is this? I mean, granted, it was late Soviet Union for you still, but you studied this very sensitive discipline that Putin is now very concerned with. Describe it to us a little bit, because it's something I just thought of right now. Sorry to put you on the spot, but it's something that is interesting to me.
The studying or learning history, it's interesting in process. It's not like one semester or one course.
No.
You absorb it somehow. And
no, you graduated from the East Falket, Kazan State.
Yeah, and it was exactly the beginning of the Perestroika, so that we were savvy for new views on history, new interpretations, new sources even. So in these terms, Kazan University gave, it was pretty much democratic institution at that time. So we all just started reading these Moskovsky Novosti, mm-hmm. articles about Gulag, about the mm-hmm. repressions, big terror. So we have our own authors at Kazan University, for example, famous publications which opened eyes for mm-hmm. us. For example, Evgeny Ginzburg, mm-hmm. Who used to live in Kazan, mm-hmm. by the way. So at the time, it was really, everything was opening, and we were just ready to get everything. So we were sort of prepared to get this new kind of interpretation of the history. But now, the process is going the opposite way.
Yeah.
So,
go ahead, Nina.
No, I just want to add, because I also studied, obviously, in the Soviet Union and supposedly got indoctrinated or didn't. I just want to say that after 1980, probably nobody got indoctrinated, because it was late Brezhnev period. Was
nobody
not really
believed it anyway.
No, it was not an indoctrination period. It was really that wonderful line that it was the period of stagnation, was really rotting and rotting and rotting. So we can safely say that after 30 years, we got back into the indoctrination mode. Because that is really quite remarkable. For 30 years, it has not happened, and we're back at that. And as Ola pointed out really very well, that it has started all before 2011. But in some ways, Putin is such a brilliant man in incursion politics. Mm-hmm. He does incursion. It's like attacking Ukraine. It's you go in here, then you go in there. It's the incursion politics.
Right.
You squeeze things, not like Stalin, sweepingly, but you squeeze things by the little and, you know,
it's infiltration. It's a spetsapparatzia,
right.
Basically.
Yeah, it's infiltration.
And it's on a number of fronts, and you he's basically turned a country. He turned Russia into a double agent that's
absolutely
working for him, basically. Rim, I want to point out. It just actually came into my head, but I was remembering my time at Kazan University, and by the time I came there to study Russian, but when my Russian got good enough, I started sitting in history classes, because it was very interesting to me to see how history is being done. This was 91. This is the very end of the Soviet Union. But we had the same history. We've learned that with the same Professor Wolfson. And I was pretty frankly shocked. I mean, he's since passed away. I was frankly shocked. This very old, very distinguished gentleman reading, it was like right on history. I could have been sitting in an American classroom, except it was in the Russian language. And then I remember one day Professor Wolfson wasn't feeling well, and there was a substitute who came in, and he was, and it was so visible, he was like reading like from the Soviet propaganda text, and the kids, the students were just not paying attention, passing notes, joking around, and I said to the girl next to me, I was like, why aren't you paying attention? She's like, would you listen to this crap? You know, and so there was even this contrast in this one classroom that I saw. There was this little blast from the past, but I bet today they'd be listening to that Soviet style substitute teacher who came in.
You know, I mean, what Kazan University gave to me, it's ability to work with the sources. It's not only listening to the, even if the academician is prominent, of course, listening to him as well, but working with the sources and give the methodics mm-hmm. of studying history. That's why I meant, talking about Kazan University. And now we are in the situation, nobody will care about the sources, about the methods, about the style, about the ways how to study history. Just one history textbook will be given.
Right.
It will be official. And now, and everything will be based on this official vision of the Soviet or Russian history.
Right. Well, it's the death of historiography. Ola, did you want to add something? You look like you did.
No, just something came to mind that what Putin's saying and sort of this narrative that he's putting forward, he doesn't really go, this is something that Peter Pomerantsev was saying the other day, he doesn't really go to great lengths to prove his points, to prove his, as Rim was saying, with that he studied in Kazan and worked with all the sources. He doesn't, like, Putin doesn't go to great lengths to prove His position that he is right, whereas I think the difference of the Soviets is that they actually really valued proving that they were right and sort of offering that proof. And also, I think the reason that he's succeeding is because his regime and the way he sort of like his mass disinformation campaign is that he can sort of mold into anything, just as the Kremlin can mold into like democracy and oligarchy, a dictatorship. Sort of, it's the way. For instance, I thought the Chamberlain comment was that the way Putin mocked Chamberlain's agreement with Hitler, but appeared to think that Stalin's sort of friendship with the Nazis was okay. I thought that was quite ironic because obviously after Crimea, the name Chamberlain started popping up in the press a lot in Britain, especially, and in the West, and these sort of dark memories of Munich 1938. So, I mean, he obviously is not right at all in saying that no one remembers it over here. It's so clever the way it molds into anything. So his narrative has a really strong anti-Western component, but it can also really easily justify an alliance with the West. Mm-hmm. So just sort of this constant confusion of where we stand and who we are. And
well, yeah. So he gave several historical episodes. I mean, he talked about, I don't think the main talk was about the history itself. The goal was different. The leader, again, softly shows and explains the ways how to this new rewritten history can serve even greater sacral goal. And the goal is, we know, to strengthen Russian statehood, which is needed to keep unique Russian civilization surrounded by this immoral Western domination.
It's almost the sanctification of the Russian state is almost what we're seeing here. Well, I'm glad you mentioned Peter Pomerantsev. He was just through Prague a couple of days ago. He's gonna appear on the podcast next week when we do the flip side of all this history. We're gonna talk about his new report on propaganda that's out there. That I'll take the opportunity to plug it now and say everybody should read Peter Pomerantsev's new report on propaganda because it's well worth the read. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and look at exactly what the point of all of Putin's historical revisionism is. I would like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me here in the studio is Rim Gilfanov, a historian who is also director of RFERL's Tatar Bashkir service. And joining us on the Skype line from New York City is Nina Khrushcheva, a professor at the New School and author of the book The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Also joining us via Skype from London is Ola Chihovlas, a journalist covering Russia whose work has appeared in The New Republic, Foreign Policy, Politico, Forbes, and elsewhere. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Attempts to reprogram societies in many countries, including our own, are obvious. And it cannot be unrelated to attempts to rewrite history, to tune it to certain geopolitical interests. While history is a scientific discipline that cannot be rewritten, if it is to be treated seriously. But to prevent this from happening, there ought to be people like you, experts, who not only inform about the events of the past in an objective and comprehensive manner, but also provide an assessment of them.
That, of course, was Vladimir Putin warning historians about attempts to manipulate history just before he gave them guidance on how he wanted them to manipulate history. The award-winning Russian author Mikhail Shishkin recently wrote a very powerful piece in The Guardian, in which he described the Russian information space as Putin's, quote, black hole of fear. I wanted to read one passage which really struck me from that, because I think it's very relevant to our discussion. Quote, "We're back to the Soviet time of total lies. The government renewed the social contract with the nation under which we had lived for decades. We know that we lie, and we know that you lie. And we continue to lie to survive. Generations have grown up under this social contract. These lies cannot even be called a sin. The power of vitality and survival is concentrated in them. The government was afraid of its nation, which is why it lied. The nation participated in the lies because it was afraid of the government. The lies are a means of survival for a society based on violence and fear. End quote. Rim, you and I spoke a lot off mic about this issue over the past couple of days, about what is going on with history. One of the arguments Shishkin makes here is basically that Putin's terrified of his nation and therefore has to lie to it. And the nation is terrified of Putin and therefore has to believe his lies. And this is all based on fear. It's also, as we noted in the early part, the sanctification of the state. But what would you say about it? Is this based on fear, do you think, at the end of the day, on both sides?
I think that the main problem here is that the whole Russian history actually was sort of, I don't say completely, but partly falsificated during the centuries. Recently, we had an interview with the guy who was appointed as a head of the Kazan Orthodox Seminary, and he was asked the question about the Kulikovo battle, which is famous. I mean, it's like pillar in of Russian history at some point. So what's the view of Church? And he said that the Kulikovo battle, he knows all different interpretations of the battle.
This was the battle between Tatars and Russians.
Yeah, it's officially pictured like between Tatars and Russians, but actually the nature of the battle was completely different. And that, but I am not going to talk about now. But it's very controversial. Is you to extent that some people consider that there was no battle actually. It was all mystificated and, you know, like set up by Russian Orthodox Church just to make this existence of Russian state or appearance of Russian state more again, this sacral thing. So his answer was like, unfortunately, this Kulikova battle theory is a part of the Russian Orthodox tradition, so he cannot even imagine how somehow to reconsider
to question it, right?
Yeah, to question or to start a kind of discussions about it. So
so it's like we're literally talking, not just figuratively, but literally talking about the sanctification of the state if this battle, which is an important part of Russian history, has become something that's part of Church doctrine. That's
so that's why I mean of course, I mean, history is such a tricky thing that, I mean, there are some mystification, there are some falsification there in every history, but what distinguishes European history in these terms, they are quite open.
Well, it's constantly revised. Yeah. It's not a science; it's one of the humanities. But it's scholarship, and it's constantly reviewed.
It was very popular
revisionist histories
among Slavic nations, for example, in 19th century. I mean, among Czech people, for them, and there were so many falsifications, but they were. They had enough courage to admit it and develop their history further. But it's not the case with Russians. They never accept.
Well, yeah, I was hoping to get a German historian on this podcast to talk about this very issue, because this is one of the things, is that Russia's really never faced its past, ever. And nobody has faced their past as courageously as the Germans have. And so it's something it's one of my regrets. I was hoping to get a German historian on this program. Nina, what are your thoughts on Mikhail Shishkin's comments that this is all based on fear? That Putin's terrified of the people are terrified of Putin, and they all have to lie together.
Well, I mean, it's I kind of imagined it's pretty basic that the state always hates the people and
hates,
people
but
hate
fears,
the state.
Fears?
Well, okay, I think fear is important, but it's much more of contempt. I think about 10 years ago, I wrote an article which was called Russian Culture of Contempt. And basically, the reason my argument was that Russia could never have a successful political societal relationship because they've never been a system which was accepted by the people, and people in turn do something for the state at their own volition. So that was the contempt. I think fear becomes part of it, but fear is not cannot exactly explain as to why we're so voluntarily always eager to go and salute the mausoleum, hate it at home, but then go to the streets and you know, speak to the greatness of the nation. Because what I find more interesting is that why in Russia state comes first, whether you fear it or not, it always comes first. Mm. And that comes from contempt. So you accept the great state because you want to live in a big, great state, but you can hate the system and the formula. Fear, from my point of view, part of it only because people also create their own fear. I was in Moscow a couple of weeks ago, registering as the fifth column because I'm a dual citizen. So I was officially registering as the fifth column, and I went in. It was took me 15 minutes. It's exactly as the state said I would do. I go to the post office, I register, everything is fine. But what I found remarkably interesting, the fear didn't come from the state. The fear came from the people who were afraid that something might go wrong. So when I was going to the post office, my mother was calling everybody who's also dual citizen. How did they do it? And they scared each other. Uh-huh. It wasn't the state that was scaring them, but that contempt to the state, that the state is out to get us, so we're going to get the state. No, you need to do this. How can we screw them over? Oh, you don't show. Can we get you another passport? I mean, she was going into this great, you know, kind of 1937 delusions of how I'm going to hide from the system and whatnot. Uh-huh. And I find that in itself, we're feeding our own fears. Because there's so much mistrust, and I think that's where we start, with that absolute mistrust between the government and the people, and then go into fear, because we really scare ourselves more than the state scares us. And then the state, and Putin is a brilliant man, he takes advantage of it because he knows exactly, being a judo master, he knows exactly which buttons to push. Mm. Where to go, where the weakness is. I think that's what the problem with today. That's why, you know, when we talk about PR, this is all PR campaign. Of course, it's all a PR campaign. It's all about, I mean, I already in that meeting, I already saw that Crimea is now going to be the new Kosovo because the nation baptized in Kherson. That's it.
Well, yeah, this was another thing. I didn't use that clip, but that was a fascinating clip there
That's, I think, Molotov Ribbentrop Pact is remarkably important, but for me, more important even, not that 20th century is not, is that we're now going to be in the Rurik era.
I want to get into this. I agree with
Nina, because, I mean, this part of the, for example, we have a story about this meeting. And I wasn't interested actually about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact because it's obvious. I mean, for us,
it's the attention grabber.
But there were some other interesting places like Khersones, and the main reason why everything that kind of things happened now, it's Ukraine. It all started with the independence of Ukraine, but till now, Russia has some, you know, leverage to the situation, what's going on in Ukraine. But now, after the events in last spring, the biggest, I would say, the more expensive, the dearest part of the Russian history just went away.
Yeah.
This is Kiev and Rus. And the Christianity, the appearance of Christianity in Russian lands. And that's why the official Moscow urgently needed some sort of justification that Russian state still have deep roots in this continent, so it can compete with other European superpowers. So Putin now...
Because otherwise it's just the Tatar state on that continent.
Yeah. Actually, the theory that the modern Russia is not actually the predecessor of Byzantine, but mostly Golden Horde.
Right.
Was rising already, was getting some support. So they decided probably just to put some obstacle on it, and they came out with this idea about Khersones and...
Why, Vladimir, this is something we talk about off mic. So yeah, I want you to expand on that. I mean, the Hristinas and the why the sudden fascination with the Rurik dynasty. You know, on Unity Day on November 4th, Putin was one of the things Putin did. It wasn't highly publicized, but it made it onto TASS. He went with Patriarch Kirill to an exhibition in Manej. About the Rurik dynasty. I use this as a little literary trick in a blog to say, you know, the Rurik dynasty ruled for 700 years, and when they left, the time of troubles came. This is the message Putin was trying to send. But he was also sending another message. This whole fascination with the Rurik dynasty has more to it. What's
the problem again in Kiev, lies in Kiev, because if you remember, Ruriks were first called to Novgorod, which is still Russia, and which was already a sort of state formation during Kievan Rus.
And a relatively democratic state formation for Russia.
Yes, I don't think that Putin is interested in this.
He's definitely not interested in that part of it.
So they again need to make these historical roots deeper as much as possible. That's why Rurik gives them opportunity to concentrate on this Novgorod part of the history.
What about the part about the sacking of Novgorod? How are they going to deal with that?
They only deal.
That'll go by the way of the secret protocols of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Exactly. We just won't mention that part, I guess.
Very selective.
Yeah. It's details only for them.
So the fascination with Rurik is because of the loss of Kyiv, essentially. Is that how you see that?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it was already sort of popular among Russian intelligentsia and before, especially in Petersburg, because they consider themselves like we are more democratic Russia, we have Novgorod, I mean, in our history. But now, as they have some problems with Kiev and Rus, I mean, Novgorod is still here.
Because Novgorod was the one that the Russian liberals always held up, that flag, as the liberal part of our history, the path not taken. Is often,
but it couldn't again survive. I mean, it was taken by Ivan Grozny.
Nina, do you? I know you were saying the Rurik dynasty is going to become increasingly important. Would you agree with what Rim said?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's very important. And in fact, in the Crimea annexation speech, where was it, March 17th, that wonderful propaganda speech that Putin gave. To justify Crimea, he was talking about Kyiv and Russia. He was talking about the fact that we're one nation. We got out of there. It is our land. We are the same people and whatnot. And I think this is, if we talk about incursion politics, this is just yet another step, but an expanding step. So forget the Romanovs. They're now the imposters, probably will be seen as imposters, yet another type of imposters. We're going to back to the real Russian roots. And also I found in his meeting with this conversation with young historians, I found it very interesting how he's now going to, they are now going to deny completely that the West has anything to do with the development of Russian statehood. So it's no longer, it's Russia that derived from Russia, and that he's very specific about this. So the West is going to be an enemy all around from the beginning of the era. And he does need them. I mean, he has been fascinated with Byzantium. Remember that Tikhon Shevkunov film, I think 2010, what was the name? The End of the Empire. I forgot the exact name. It was the Gibel Imperii. And that created direct roots from Byzantine Empire to the Russian Empire. And now we are creating the direct routes from the great Putin to the great Rurik dynasty. And he's another thing, and maybe I'm jumping the gun, but something that I thought was very important. He was talking about Yaroslav the Wise,
yes.
Which was exactly, it was very important because he was saying, well, he really didn't take care of his succession rather well. It was very complicated. So what's the message here? We're going to take care of our succession quite well. So there's a lot of this very hidden ideological messages, which speak, of course, to what both Ola and Rim were saying, that in Russia, history is not history. In Russia, history is ideology. And it's not just Putin. It was Khrushchev. It was Stalin. It was Brezhnev. It was way before that. So unfortunately for us, we're just basically repeating the same paradigm of historical greatness.
I'm delighted that you all have brought up the Yaroslav Mudry, the Rurik dynasty, because I intentionally left this out of the podcast because I thought it was going to be too obscure and I was going to try to slide it in myself at some point, and you all brought it up and did my job for me, which is wonderful. Ola, any thoughts on this? You've been quiet for a while.
This sanctification of the state and the cult of the state and this sort of pseudo history is obviously nothing new in Russian. It was before Putin. Putin's using it now. And I think the Shushkin article that you mentioned, in which he says that we're being lied to and we're lying and everyone knows we're lying, is psychologically quite obviously hugely disturbing, sort of the cynicism that has arisen from so long of a society living under lies for so long. I mean, what truth do you let out? What do you not let out? It's such a difficult question right now.
Well, this is something that Peter Pomerantsev will be on next week. It's something Peter brings up repeatedly, is that this is getting to the point now, though, where it's going from the point of propaganda and lies to downright craziness, where you don't even know, the people making the lies don't even know what to believe anymore. And that's when a society can really get into a lot of trouble. That's when it gets into North Korea territory, right? I mean, if you read the Orphan Master's Son, this wonderful novel about contemporary North Korea that won the Pulitzer last year, there is a bit where one character says to another, it doesn't matter what happened. What matters is the story. We have to come up with a story about what happened. And we're to the point where nobody believes what's real anymore. And you have to want, Nina, you definitely look, you want to.
I just wanted, because, you know, my story is kind of that, is that everybody makes a lie about Khrushchev or Khrushchev's son and how he was a Benedict Arnold of contemporary Russia. And it doesn't really matter whether you can prove it or not. What matters is you make up a story, and if the story fits into your ideology, you're good. You don't really need to prove anything, as Ola was saying. And I think that the Soviet Union also never needed to prove anything. They just had better professionals who explained stuff better. Right. But
and they had an overarching ideology basically.
Right. And so the ideology was an explanation. So in some ways, ideology would cover all this factual imperfections. But once again, I mean, I'm sorry to be such a has such a dim view of whatever is happening today in Russia, in a sense that it's so entirely not original. Even the big lie, I mean, you know, remember Goebbels, the big lie, that was it was, once again, we already experienced that. Stalin's was a big lie. Ideology covers everything. In fact, Nikita Khrushchev, who tried to reform the system, and perfectly as he did with his own numerous problems, if you read his memoir, talking about amateur historians, because of course all of them want to contribute to historical perspective, he was saying, yes, Stalin did this and Stalin did that, and he is responsible for the death of so many people, and World War II was lasting for so long precisely because of Stalin's imperfections. But if we consider him in terms of world communism, he really was a very positive figure. Like, I'm sorry, I cannot reconcile that,
right,
the two.
Right.
So he's either a positive figure or he slaughtered his own country. So in some ways, it is a lie has to be big. So the lie in the Soviet Union is that if you're good for the world communism, nothing else matters. And so Putin is doing the same thing. And I think that's why Rurik is so important, because we're going to go back to that original statehood, the 1900s, and also very important that he says in his conversation, is that, well, the further you go in history, the harder it is to check what's really happening. It's like, well, that's exactly the point, because it's so hard to check what happened. You can make up all sorts of things and create your own historical past.
Well, this is a great segue into some a couple of interesting clips from the historian Nikita Sokolov speaking on Dosh TV this week regarding Putin's meeting with young historians. Let's listen to Nikita Sokolov.
The thing that is important to understand here is that Vladimir Putin does not understand history as scholarship. He does not understand that this is scholarly knowledge that you cannot manipulate. He only understands how to apply history through our television channels as a means to indoctrinate the population. It is obvious that this is not a discussion about history. It is a discussion about justifying the current authorities. This is why there was the gathering of historians to establish an objective history in the interests of Russia.
I mean, that about sums it up. I mean, this is pretty much what we've been driving at through this whole thing. And then, Nina, you pointed out the Soviet example. I mean, it all went back to the ideology there. If you don't have to prove it, either you have science or you have ideology, right? If you have normal historical research, you have to prove it. You have to back it up. You have to source it. You know, but if you have an ideology, well, that's an alternative way to do this. You plug it into the ideology and it's tautological. Mm-hmm. For this all to work, doesn't there have to be an ideology?
Well, and I think that's what they're making. I mean, we had Tocqueville's ideology of communism, right? Mm-hmm. And now I think something that Ola really very well summed up at the beginning is that, you know, Putin didn't happen in 2011, all things that we're talking about. They started happening since 2000, but we just, Mikhail Khodorkovsky is in prison, but it's only Mikhail Khodorkovsky, and so we'd explain it away, but then 5 years later, something else would happen. So this is all these little incursions, but in the meantime, ideology was created, because it's like the archipelago. You have a little iceberg here, iceberg there, and suddenly there is a whole island. And the ideology is Russianism. The ideology is anti-West. And I think that's...
Is that enough?
It's enough for now. It's enough for now, because now if they're framing Crimea, Krim Nash, I mean, that's right. People who are... I'm sure you guys know that, but I was in Moscow, as I said, registering myself as an enemy, basically, in quotes, so far, in quotes. But it divided families, it divided friends. People suddenly, even those who were on my side, were saying, no, but you have to understand, Crimea is important. Alexei Navalny and Mikhail Khodorkovsky both speak, and I read very carefully what they said. They really did not say that Krim Nash. However, they were very careful in saying that, if we are presidents, we're probably not going to give it back. So that for now, I think it's enough. But also something that I want to point out that if you looked at recent polls, Putin's approval is back to 49. It's going back down. So as we said, it was an emotional rise with Krim Nash and Crimea hours. It was a hit of cocaine. So now I imagine they would probably need another war, or something.
Well, this is,
conversation of the war.
This is a recurring theme on the podcast, this need for permanent mobilization, a permanent hit of cocaine, and what's next. But if they're building an ideology, that's something else. That's not a hit of cocaine. That's something else.
But they build it. It's the Russia of the grandiose Russia of the past. Because Russia, once again... No, you don't agree with that?
No, keep going. I want to let you finish.
I almost don't want to agree with it myself. But the thing about Russia historically, and I'm hopefully Reem would agree with me, that because it is all of it is always based on the state, and then the state is based on certain ideology, however skimpy the ideology may seem to us, it is still a state ideology. So for that reason, one of the problems that Russia has is that it obviously has the past. There's a lot of past there. It barely has the present, because the present is the discussion of the past. And therefore, it has no future, because your whole ideology is that what Yaroslav the Wise did at some point, or Sofia Paleologia paid a lot of attention to security, as one time Nikolai Patrushev said, and therefore we have to. So ideology becomes the past. It is very bad for the future, but it can carry you through until 2017.
Yeah, I guess that's all they're thinking of. Because when I'm making drawing the parallel with communism was a holistic system of thought that explained everything, explained the history of the world and human motivation and psychology and everything. So everything could be just plugged back in and justified with this tautological ideology. Russianness doesn't quite cut it.
We're
in Twitter time. Okay, go for that. So it's already solved.
So we're back
to a problem. It's tied to Orthodox tradition, Orthodox culture, Orthodox church, with own cult, with own institutions. So in these terms, we already have sort of, I mean, not completely, but ideologically committee who will decide that part of the problem. By the way, the meeting went on in frames of exhibition, and I just saw some pictures, and one picture there was a slogan, Motherland or Death, Отчизна или смерть, Отечество или смерть. So it shows in 2-3 words the main essence of the meeting, the main essence, the signal, the message Vladimir Putin wants to give to the population.
Well, if orthodoxy is going to be the anchor here, and I think you're right, Rim. I was trying to, but what came to mind. I was thinking a comment Mozgovoy, the rebel leader in Luhansk, made at this. I don't know if any of you saw this. There was this People's Tribunal, Narodny Tribunal, that was shown where two rapists were sent. One of them was sentenced to death, and this was put up on YouTube
By voting.
By voting. Yeah, but what caught a lot of people's attention also is what Mozgovoy, the rebel leader in Luhansk, said at the end of the trial, that there's just been too many women out in bars. Basically, you know, you're asking for it, kind of saying, and that women should stay out of bars and stay out of restaurants at risk of arrest. You have to remember you're Russians and start behaving like it. And this drew a lot of attention, a lot of comments about some kind of Russian Taliban, you know, coming to the Donbass. And you have to wonder how attractive an ideology that is going in this direction is going to have.
I mean, if we talk about orthodoxy, and we're going back to very patriarchal orthodoxy.
We're going to very fundamentalist orthodoxy.
Fundamental, exactly. Because we're talking about Chersonists, and if we're talking about Chersonists, that would be incredibly fundamentalist. So that's the roots of Russian orthodoxy. It could be very, very Taliban. I mean, in Donetsk, they had this fantastic museum complex, which is called Izolyatsiya, isolation. And now the rebels took it over. And I saw footage of their interviews of those rebels, and it was remarkable. I mean, they were talking about prostitutes. I mean, modern art is prostitutes. It actually reminded me of 1962, the Manege exhibit, and Khrushchev's talking to avant-garde artists, telling them that, you know, it's not a portrait, it's an ass. So it was kind of the same very fundamentalist, very socialist, realist conversation. And it could be, very easily could become a Taliban of
Or at least it's very Puritan.
Cultural,
to
very Puritan. I mean, go back to those original roots. I mean, maybe, well, Ola is not Russian, but I still am, so I'm going to wear that kakoshnik, or whatever it is, the well, Russian what, crown.
One of the things Mozgovoy said is that women should stay home and embroider. Don't go out.
Well,
stay
here
home
you
and
go.
Embroider.
Yeah. Knit.
Well, I don't think that they mean in the future they will be that kind of traditions in Russia. I mean, it's already excess, and it will not be the typical. But nevertheless, they already started to make kind of, you know, very conservative society. Yeah. Just remember this anti-gay, propaganda laws. And it's going this direction.
This direction. It's a revolt against Western liberalism in a lot of ways. Ola, you got the first word. And by tradition, you get the last word before we wrap up. Any final thoughts before we call it a day?
Well, I hope this sort of ultra-conservatism doesn't have a future as an ideology in the very long term. We've talked about a lot of things. Essentially, what's happening, this cult of the state as well, is just limiting and annihilating any kind of Russians. It's just limiting demands that Russians have the right to make. And I hope there will be an adequate response from the few liberal journalists that are left in Russia.
What's left of civil society. But I don't think civil society is going away. I think we've written it off too early. I'm an optimist by nature. And I don't think this is over. I think we're going through.
Oh, it's not over. No, by far.
It's at some point when this bright future doesn't arrive,
Which very soon it doesn't.
The scales are going to fall from people's eyes. And I think this may be sooner than we think. But then again, I'm always accused of being ridiculously optimistic, and I wear that badge proudly. And on that note, we will wrap it up for today, since that's all we have time for. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been Rim Gilfanov, a historian who is also the director of RFRL's Tatar Bashkir service. And joining us on the Skype line from New York City has been Nina Khrushcheva, a professor at the New School and author of the book, The Lost Khrushchev, a journey into the gulag of the Russian mind. Also joining us via Skype, making her first but hopefully not last appearance in the podcast from London, has been Ola Chihoklas, a journalist covering Russia whose work has appeared in The New Republic, Foreign Policy, Politico, Forbes, and elsewhere. Thanks to all of you for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And I'd also like to thank our patient, brilliant, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome and indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and the newly launched Power Vertical feed at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.